This afternoon, I'd like to reflect on the theme of joyful effort. Recently, I was reading an article about a monastery of monks in Japan called the Marathon Monks, whose meditation practice is running. And every morning, they get up and they put on their straw sandals and their robes, and they run, and they run in all weathers, in heat, in snow, in rain, sun. They run. And it really is the beginning and the end of their practice and their training. And at the end of this training, the marathon monks, that small handful that make it to the end, they are running 2 marathons a day for 100 consecutive days. The graduates, as I mentioned, are few. But when they talk about it, they seek, they say, to train their mind, to open their hearts, to surrender a sense of self and division. When they talk about their practice of running, they speak about nurturing a sublime and unshakable inner clarity and freedom. When I lived in India, I would occasionally come across sadhus whose practice was standing, people who had taken vows to stand without ever sitting down or lying for up to 12 years at a time. They would do standing meditation. This is 24 hours a day. I have a neighbor who has a son who has very severe Down syndrome, who every day requires a constant, unending vigilance and attention. Caring for him takes an ocean of patience and love and dedication. And they speak of it. They speak of raising their son as a spiritual journey. It takes effort to get to a retreat. It takes effort for us to get out of bed in the morning. It takes effort to raise a child. It takes effort to practice meditation. It takes effort to follow our dreams. It takes, as we see on retreat, a considerable perseverance just to take one step after another in walking meditation, when there may be a multitude of voices inwardly that are shouting at us to flee or do something easier. It takes effort to sit with ourselves in stillness, in times that are not always easy, when we do know that there are countless other more gratifying, more accessible paths that we could follow in that moment. Every journey in our lives asks for effort, and in a very real way, effort is the visible face of what we are dedicated to and what we're committed to. To bring anything at all to fulfillment in this life, to deepen in anything, to explore any new landscape, to learn, requires us to be present, to be dedicated, to extend the effort that is needed. Sometimes I think that the only instruction I would ever really need to give in meditation is just to show up. You know, no matter what happens, in the face of all the doubts and all the struggles, just keep showing up. Learn to sit like a mountain that can remain steadfast and firm and receptive amidst all the different weathers and storms and winds that come. And I do have faith that to some extent this is true. I have faith that if we simply keep showing up, and this is true in my experience, that our meditation deepens, that we find an increasing capacity to open, to learn, to listen inwardly, that if we just keep showing up, we find ourselves increasingly being touched by life inwardly and outwardly. And yet I also know that it's possible to keep showing up physically and to psychically be somewhere quite else, very far from our bodies, very far from this moment. So there is an open question about how we show up. I'm sure we have all experienced this in practice, that physically we sit like a Buddha and our mind is like a clown. And and nobody knows but us. This is the reality. Nobody knows but us. Nobody knows what you do when you sit but you. Just as you don't know what I do when I sit. I only know this. It's apparent that effort is always going to be part of our lives. It's always going to be part of our practice. It's going to be part of every journey. We don't reach a point in our life where, you know, suddenly effort is no longer relevant or applicable. The kind of effort that we make in our practice and in our lives reflects much about who we sense ourselves to be. The kind of effort we make reflects what we have faith in, what we sense to be possible for us. In the Buddha and in this tradition, there's so much spoken about wise effort, and yet so many different views. One teacher might say that if you want to realize serenity, be prepared to sweat beads. Another teacher said that there will come a time in your practice when you will look back on all your heroic efforts as futile actions performed in a dream. We hear about the effort sometimes we must make to strive, to realize, to liberate ourselves. I had a teacher at a point in my own practice who would suddenly shout at us when we were sitting still. The whole meditation would be quiet and silent, and suddenly this voice would boom out and say, you know, work, work, work for your own enlightenment. And we would all suddenly, you know, perk up as if we were really on the job, you know. And somehow there was in that, I read in that, a certain suggestion that as if all transformation and possibilities of freedom rested entirely upon the personal effort and exertion and responsibility that I took upon myself in a sitting. Sometimes we hear about the effort to be simply present, a kinder, gentler, more spacious, opening kind of effort, just to be simply with each moment as it is. Sometimes we're puzzled when we listen. We hear goals emphasized, that there are goals to realize, things to achieve, to attain. Sometimes we hear that there are no goals, that everything we seek for is already imminent. It is here with us already, waiting to be revealed. I think in our practice, effort is something very important to understand and to investigate, because effort is not just a means to awakening. It's not just a vehicle to awakening. The kind of effort we make in our practice is in itself a very fertile source of understanding and awakening. Because our effort, the kind of effort we bring to our practice and to our lives, of course, is constantly reflecting who we believe ourselves to be. Sometimes the effort we make in our practice and our lives is reflecting very historical images about ourselves that we have carried with us for decades. reflecting our sense of identity that lies at the core of our being. Sometimes our effort reflects not only what we sense to be possible for us, but our effort can also reflect what we feel to be impossible. When our effort is born of unconscious self-images, it really tends to manifest as unwise and unskillful effort that doesn't lead to greater freedom and joy and well-being, but instead tends to manifest or indeed perpetuate the very life patterns and tendencies we would most like to be free of. I see people in practice sometimes, they're working so hard and they're trying so hard and they feel that they're doing everything right, and they end up household feeling, you know, why do I feel so miserable still? And yet the kind of effort that they're bringing to practice is often an extension of a belief system, which in itself is sometimes lost in struggle. If we look at our lives and we look at our practice, the effort that we bring to each of them is very likely to resemble one another. And I'd like to reflect on some of the kind of more predominant effort patterns that I come across that you might see a little bit, maybe some of them reflected in yourself, and especially the more unconscious effort patterns. There's the striver, let's feature the striver in this story, who comes to practice with a menu, an agenda of goals that must be attained, where meditation practice is treated as a kind of test of worthiness, just as life can be viewed as a test of worthiness, or sometimes a mountain to climb, a place to succeed or prove themselves. Now, the striver is very easily identifiable in meditation practice and in life because it has a particular vocabulary that strongly features good and bad, success and failure. And you see, the striver is always looking for signs of progress and equally signposts of regression and failure. The checklist is brought into every sitting and every walking. How many breaths in a row was I with that sitting? How many times did I move? How many insights did I have today? We can see in the striver this bringing of such a heightened level of self-consciousness into practice and into life, which always measuring everything. And, you know, sometimes we don't think of ourselves as a striver because we're not sweating beads. But, you know, we can be very quiet strivers. And it's often evidenced by the voice of the judge. The inner critic is the steady companion of the striver. There's a kind of effort which is much more ambivalent, even lethargic, a kind of half-hearted, you know, where we do show up. We can be really meticulous about showing up, but it feels like a lucky accident, you know, if we run into a breath every now and then. That's what they were talking about, you know. We get surprised by moments of sensitivity, you know, and think, oh, gosh, how did that happen, you know. And it's almost like waiting. It's almost like waiting, like we can wait in meditation and we can wait in life. We're waiting for our meditation to deliver us a glimpse of peace, or waiting for our meditation to deliver us a glimpse of calmness, as if all that's required of us is to show up with this kind of expectancy. But we can sometimes sense it's half-hearted. It's a kind of disengaged effort that at times does reflect in an inner belief that life is something that just happens to us, that we're not really a conscious participant in creating the kind of world or the kind of moment we live in and experience. And sometimes this ambivalent or half-hearted effort, I think it manifests at times quite a low sense of expectation, a low sense of possibility inwardly. And in just as a striver can be a casualty of very inflated expectations, it is also important to be a casualty of reduced or minimized expectations. Certainly my sense in the West is that more people suffer from too limited expectations in practice than too inflated expectations. And if you were to go and practice in Asia, just show up in any old monastery, you know, you could pretty much take it for granted that the abbot of that monastery would assume that you're practicing to be enlightened, that you're practicing to be liberated. And they wouldn't have any doubt that it was possible for you to do that either. That would be part of the understanding. This is not always true of us. Sometimes we come into practice with a very limited sense of possibility and vision, resigning ourselves to far less than what is possible for us in life and in practice. There's another kind of effort which is much more of a sort of aversive effort, where we meditate, but meditation practice is often approached as a measurer, a kind of onerous task, as if we're taking medicine that tastes really foul, that we've heard that it's going to be really good for us in the long run. So we could sit and we walk almost as if we're fulfilling a sense of obligation, as if it's a duty. And underlying that sense of showing up, there can be this theme of aversion. And it's sometimes easy to spot that, because when we approach practice with that underlying theme of aversion, you can pretty much rely on it that we'll spend a lot of time in fantasy and daydream. That fantasy and daydream are our most accessible avenues of camouflaging aversion. There's also a kind of effort that manifests much more as willpower, the warrior, you know, the meditative warrior, who treats life and treats practice basically as something that's filled with obstacles to be conquered. And then effort is to transcend. It often has a sort of forcing, subduing tone in it. And you can sense that the meditative warrior, I mean, there's a kind of warrior that's good in meditation, but there's a kind of willpower warrior that carries with it very fixed views of how things should be, how our experience should be, how life should be, how I should be, how others should be. And you can sense a sort of rigidity within those views. I came across a newspaper article which really kind of illustrated this for me. And please, this is not a cultural slur. If any of you have European roots, this could happen to anybody. A motorist drove his BMW into the Havel River after obediently following instructions beamed to its satellite guided navigation system. Oblivious to stop signs, never mind the river stretched out before him, the 57-year-old driver from Hamburg unhesitatingly continued on his journey, past a stop sign, down a ferry ramp, and then into the river. Sedately, his BMW sank in about 13 feet of water. Neither he nor his passenger were hurt, but ship traffic on the river was stopped for 2 hours while divers fished out his car. "You can't always rely on technology," said a coast guard, showing unusual Teutonic restraint. The accident happened on Christmas Day when the couple went out for a drive and came to a river where a ferry operates. However, that crucial piece of information wasn't stored in the navigation system on their BMW. Displayed on the dashboard, it showed instead a bridge, when it should have indicated a ferry. As a result, the driver ignored the warnings of the real world. Signs, people shouting, flashing red lights, that sort of thing. Placing his faith instead on his electronic counterpart, he was rewarded by being dumped in the river. I think, you know, it's like practice is about heeding the warning signs. You know, the flashing red lights, people shouting, all of those signals, not on our ideas of how things should be. Most people in my experience don't carry just one dimension of effort within themselves. I mean, depending on our mind state of the moment, as well as our historical beliefs, we can find a number of these different qualities and kinds of efforts appearing throughout our day. We can start the day as a striver and end up in the midst of ambivalence. More, I think, I see that effort is an invitation to insight. What kind of effort we bring to our life, what kind of effort we bring to our practice, it's always communicating something, our effort. Sometimes our effort is communicating just the mind state of the moment. Our effort is communicating doubt or craving or aversion or anxiety. Sometimes our effort is communicating some of those more fixed belief systems that we hold about ourselves, our self-images that dominate our lives. And I feel we're invited to listen really well to what is being communicated. You know, there are some psychological theories that profess that our character and our personality and our way of seeing and thinking and feeling is somehow formed and solidified by the time we enter our early adolescence, and that the rest of our lives is essentially about finding the strategies and the formulas that make that character more acceptable and presentable in the world and to others. Hopefully not offending too many people and earning some measure of affirmation and love. So in these theories it's suggested that if, you know, by the time we're a young teenager, if we're fearful or ambitious or aggressive or passive or loving or generous, kind of be who we're going to be until we die, with only minor modifications possible. I think this is a really depressing theory. I mean, if any of you, like me, maybe look back on your early adolescence as something less than delight, and say, that's how I'm going to be until I die. It's also, I must say, a theory that is totally at odds with this teaching and tradition. Because what is really intrinsic in this teaching is the possibility of very, very profound transformation. The essence of this teaching really lies in the simple truth that profound and unshakable peace and compassion and freedom are possible for each of us. That our history, our character, our portfolio are really not obstacles, that there is nothing that is an obstacle to that. At the heart of this teaching, there is almost the promise that the end of struggle, the end of conflict, is indeed part of this path. That the deep joy and wisdom possible is part of our own consciousness heritage, we might put it. So that we don't practice just to simply expand our portfolio of strategies that allows us to cope better. You know, mindfulness and coping are completely incompatible concepts. We don't practice in order to cope better and yet somehow carry within us some unchanged, unaltered core of belief and identity that we practice in order to be free. And effort really plays a part in that transformation. it's not just the results of our effort. It's not just the goals that we might reach that are so significant. But what is most revealing and a place of deep insight is the quality of our effort. What it is teaching us about ourselves, what it's teaching us about our consciousness, about our sense of self. Because in the kind of effort that we make and what it reflects, it's really there that we learn about what leads to suffering and about what leads to the end of suffering. And that is something that we really need to place in the moment. It's not as if we place that somehow at the end of our path. But our practice is about that on a moment-to-moment level, what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. What is the source of joy and what is the source of sorrow? Dogen, the great Zen master, put it, he said, in your meditation, you yourself are the mirror reflecting the solution of your problem. The human mind has absolute freedom within its true nature. You can understand this freedom intuitively. Don't work towards freedom, but allow the work itself to be freedom. We learn how to allow the practice itself to be a practice of freedom, a practice of peace. That we're not so much practicing for compassion, we're not so much practicing for freedom, for peace, but we are practicing those qualities, bringing them to embodiment, to fulfillment in the moment. In this practice, we're encouraged to cultivate not just wise and skillful effort, but also to cultivate joyful effort. To discover the very deep joy of opening, of deepening, of being touched by each moment fully. It is so difficult for us, I think, in many ways to define joy. You know, we can define conflict, we can define often suffering, we can define sadness. But joy is somehow for us in our lives something that is difficult to capture in words. I mean, moments of joy are often so unexpected, so unpredictable. The moments when we suddenly find our heart singing just in the face of a bud on a tree, or our laugh of a child, or a simple movement within our body by something we hear, sense, touch. Those moments of joy, we can sense almost a breaking open of any kind of sense of tightness, contractedness. And with that breaking open, the kind of lightness and the spaciousness and the simple delight in being, simple delight in the moment. It's not just in the face of the pleasant either. We can discover that opening, that deepening, that sense of joy of being, even in the face of the difficult. Joy has something to do with our capacity to embrace, our ability to embrace life, to embrace the moment, to embrace ourselves. It is almost, I think it is at times surprising to us because we are so prone to focusing, highlighting, noticing the imperfect. That sometimes that inclination to highlight and focus upon the imperfect almost blinds us to the suchness of life in the moment, to what is possible in our hearts. There's a Chinese saying, it says, if I keep a green bough in my heart, the singing bird will come. And there's something so simple in that, about keeping a green bough in our hearts. So the singing bird can come. I often feel that our practice, our mindfulness practice, is really almost about sensing that possibility of keeping a green bough in our heart. Our nurturing of our capacity to listen, to see, to touch with wholeheartedness. The joy of non-separation. The joy of being present. In moments of joy, we do sense that it's not just a state of mind or a fleeting experience, that there's some quality of heartfelt appreciation of the whole of life. It's the joy of being awake. One time when the Buddha was traveling, you know, in his journeys through all these Indian villages, a villager came up to him and asked him, you know, why are you so radiant? Are you some kind of saint? Are you some kind of angel? Are you some kind of deity? And the Buddha just answered, he said, no, I'm awake. There are two dimensions, I would say, of joyful effort, and both of them are very interwoven. One dimension of joyful effort is vision. The quality of aspiration that we hold at the heart of ourselves and at the heart of our practice. The sense of possibility that we have faith in and trust in. That we practice in order to discover the mind of a Buddha within ourselves. The other dimension of joyful effort is confidence. Trusting, having a very deep faith on a moment-to-moment level, in our capacity to realize and to bring to fulfillment our sense of aspiration and vision. On its deepest level, this quality of confidence in meditation practice is said to be one of the characteristics of awakening, the cessation of doubt. Being so deeply established in realized trust, in realized faith in ourselves and in our practice. Now these two dimensions of vision and confidence always need to be in balance. When they fall out of balance, that's when we tend to fall into unskillful effort. You know, if we have only vision or an inflated sense of vision without confidence, that's when we get lost in goals and judgments and shoulds and expectations and striving. When we have confidence without vision, you know, we tend to flounder in just trying to preserve a sense of familiarity and safety. My sense is that vision or a sense of aspiration is so important in this practice and teaching. That it is concerned with profound transformation, that we really sense in ourselves that glimmer of the possibility of ending sorrow and conflict and struggle. That we really sense in ourselves that our practice is dedicated moment to moment to the realization of very profound compassion and understanding. That we hold within ourselves that intuition of freedom, the intuition of liberation. However, it is also important to understand that our personal sense of vision and aspiration is not something that's static. Probably many of you have seen your sense of vision and aspiration in practice change dramatically over the period that you've been practicing. When I began to practice, you know, like a moment of peace would have been just absolutely terrific. A moment of clarity, like that would have been just amazing. You know, coming to practice out of a place of a lot of confusion and desperation. If someone had said to me, hold as your vision, you know, resting in profound emptiness, I would have thought they were talking about somebody else. If you come into practice with, you know, a broken heart, your sense of vision in that moment might just be to find some healing, some place of calmness within yourself. If you come into practice feeling overwhelmed by the world, you know, your aspiration may just be to find some spaciousness, some equanimity, some inner refuge. If you come into practice feeling overwhelmed by people's expectations, by life's demands, your aspiration in practice might be one simply to find a way of reclaiming some inner authenticity and authority. And this is all fine. It is not as if we should begin necessarily with some huge aspiration of understanding emptiness or freedom or boundless consciousness. However, it is also important to see that our aspiration in a way flavors our practice, doesn't it? And what is really important to see is that sometimes we do practice and we do seek what we came to find. We do find moments of clarity, we find moments of authenticity, we find places of peace, we find places of greater equanimity. These are wonderful, these are blessings. And it doesn't mean it's the end of the path. They are not destinations. You know, that's not the time when we then say, okay, it's done and dusted, you know, I pick up my zafu, pack my equipment away, you know, and live happily ever after. I think what is important to see that these moments of realizing what we aspire to, in a way they're beginnings. You know, discovering some, even a glimpse of calmness, is the beginning of discovering an unshakable balance. Discovering a beginning of healing is finding a beginning of how to bring an end perhaps to all the struggle and all the sorrow. Finding a glimpse of compassion for ourselves is the beginning of deepening in a bottomless compassion that can listen to all of the cries of the world. Finding one moment of letting go is a beginning of discovering an unshakable freedom that's never colored by holding and by grasping. So it is almost as if the realization of just those moments of aspiration are also moments of inspiration to widen, to deepen our sense of possibility and also our confidence and faith in ourselves to realize those possibilities. We all have dreams and longings that bring us to meditation practice. Sometimes it's just words that we've read, words that we've heard spoken, people that we've admired and who've evoked a sense of possibility within us. We all have dreams and longings. A yearning for depth, a yearning for richness, a yearning for love and for authenticity. And it is actually really important to almost give form or to articulate those dreams and longings to ourselves and to place them in the center of our practice. To learn how to breathe life into those sometimes whispered dreams and whispered longings for freedom, for compassion, for intimacy. To learn how to breathe life into them and to place them really in our moment and let our aspirations be our path. So that our longing for peace becomes then our path of peace. Our longing with every breath we breathe, with every step that we take, that we really see that breath and that step is in the service of bringing that aspiration to fulfillment. Not in the future, but in this moment. It is that sense of aspiration in our practice that is really at the root of joyful effort. It's what allows our effort to be joyful because we know what it is dedicated to. We know what it is in the service of. And we have confidence in that. And so every step and every breath is actually a gesture of peace. It's a gesture of compassion. It's a gesture of equanimity. It's a gesture of freedom. A Tibetan teacher once said that you should practice this path as if you have 1,000 lifetimes in which to do it, and yet not waste one single precious moment. Confidence is the other dimension of joyful effort. We do see that nothing leeches joy out of our life more than doubt and fear. There's a Sufi saying that says, fear is the cheapest room in the house. I'd like to see you in better accommodation. We see that, don't we? I mean, fear makes us look for the cheapest room in the house, the lowest possible aspiration, the lowest possible sense of vision, the safest place to inhabit, the most protected place to live. But then we blind ourselves to that sense of possibility and expansiveness that may be available to us. And yet we surely meet, all of us, doubt and fear in our life and in our practice. I would say probably for the first 10 years of my practice, every moment was filled with doubt. It was a long 10 years. And yet it's so interesting, doubt, isn't it? Because, I mean, we can try and dissect it. We never get any answers. I used to find the only way, and this may not at all be pertinent to you. When I used to have my doubt crises, what am I doing? You know, why am I doing this? Am I getting anywhere? You know, all that big doubt angst. I never really could find anybody who could convince me that it was worth continuing. I mean, everything sounded good, you know, but I never found anybody really convinced me. But the only way I ever found to deal with doubt is, first of all, I knew very clearly what I was coming from. You know, I knew, I mean, there was no way I was going to dress it up. I knew that I was coming from a place of confusion, scatteredness, fragmentation, you know, you name it, I had it. I didn't know where I was going, but I surely knew I didn't want to go back. So in that way, it became sort of choiceless. You know, there was still doubt, but it was almost as if the unknown was certainly preferable to the known. So that way, it was kind of an easy decision. I think we also see that doubt, that confidence is deepened really in the midst of doubt. The confidence doesn't live separate from doubt. You know, the times when we feel overwhelmed and ready to throw our hands up in despair, and yet find sometimes just that little part of ourselves that is willing to stay present, that's where we learn about confidence. You know, that the times when something is difficult and we really want to flee into a fantasy or a daydream, and yet sometimes we just find that little bit of effort to come back and be present, where we're learning about confidence. You know, the time when we turn towards our body and it feels impossible and solid and contracted, and yet we find just that little capacity to probe and to investigate rather than flee, that's when we learn about confidence. Every time that we find the willingness to stay present rather than abandon ourselves and abandon the moment, it's where we learn about confidence. And in some ways, adversity is the classroom of confidence. Difficulty is the classroom of confidence. And somehow it gets easier. It gets easier to forsake the habit of abandonment. Abandonment starts to seem like less and less an attractive prospect. Even when being present is difficult, at least it is present. It is something so preferable than just being unconscious. When we turn towards the difficult rather than abandon, what we do discover is that which seems at first so unapproachable and impenetrable is often much less solid than it first appears. That which seems so unapproachable or impenetrable in our life, whether it's another person or a mental state within ourselves, we see that it's given solidity by aversion and by fear and by resistance. And by when those moments when we actually turn and look directly towards it, it starts to soften. It starts to soften. We also perhaps sense that confidence is undermined and sabotaged primarily by being unconscious. You know, when we're unconscious and unmindful, I mean, I'm sure we've all found this, we keep finding ourselves walking in these same old, tired, frustrating circles that we've walked a million times before. You know, whether it's the circle of judgment, the circle of reactivity, the circle of fantasy, the circle of greed. And after a while, you know, we start to notice it, like, this is not new. How many times have I been here? And we also see that it happens when we're unconscious, when we're conscious, when we're awake. We don't walk the same tired, old, familiar circles. Participating in the old tired routines that don't contribute to awakening, to opening, that instead engages in activities that further delusion. And that, it's good that it's frustrating. It's actually good that it's frustrating. It's good that we're not satisfied with it. You know, dissatisfaction is not a negative thing. You know, you think the Buddha started out as a really disappointed man. You know, he was really disappointed that the life he'd been told was going to deliver him, all this protection against living, it didn't work. You know, dissatisfaction is not negative. There is a creative element within dissatisfaction which is really important. I mean, certainly there can be a dissatisfaction which is aversive and resistance, and this is not helpful. But dissatisfaction that is simply recognizing the unsatisfactory nature of suffering is important. If we weren't dissatisfied with that, we would have no reason to seek for freedom. We would resign ourselves to a lifetime of suffering and struggle. What we do, we see that being unconscious makes us very habit-prone. Being mindful makes us more enlightenment-prone. Mm-hmm. And we might think of meditation practice as a way of making ourselves more enlightenment-prone. Less prone to fall into those old familiar ruts, prone to understand what is happening in each moment. Dorothy Brandt once said, you know, you should follow your dreams and act as if it is impossible to fail. I think this is the right way to practice. You know, follow your dreams and act as if it's impossible to fail. You know, no matter if your mind is half asleep, you know, or your body is aching, or you know, you seem to have a multiple hindrance storm. Act as if it's impossible to fail. Just keep showing up. When I first read the story of the marathon monks, you know, at first I thought the hero of the story must surely be the one who graduated, you know, who ran 2 marathons a day for 100 consecutive days. And they might have been the hero of the story. But the hero of the story might also be the personal struggle within the ingrained, how much we seek for the liberation within that. Mindfulness practice, my sense is it on one hand reveals to us where we are and what is. But that's not the end of the story in mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice also reveals to us what is possible in where we are and what is. And that is what makes it a practice of liberation. I think initially we think of effort in a very dualistic way, you know, that it's a means to get from A to B. It's a means to arrive at a certain destination. My sense is that the more we practice, the more that duality starts to fall away. And we see that mindfulness practices and wise, joyful effort is not about getting from A to B, but it's about bringing B into A. It's about learning to bring everything that we aspire to into the moment we are in. Then I sense when our practice is really in the service of ending sorrow, that when our practice is really in the service of awakening moment to moment, that is when we have joyful effort in our practice. The times when we're learning to smile upon ourselves, to smile upon the moment, because it is the effort of awakening.